She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And trust me when I say our guest today is going to give us an amazing amount of wonderful things to think about in terms of the ways that he and his organization have changed the world. Just a little shout out about our show today. It is made possible due to the generous support of the Fairfax companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. Since 1989, Fairfax has strived to be a leader in sustainability, and they are truly dedicated to improving the environment through creative and innovative management practices. And I thought it was very relevant today to talk about what they're doing as we speak. They're producing some of the highest grade organic compost that can be found on the market today. And their business in this area is literally booming. And they're doing it all from green waste that they collect through their recycling facilities. It's great. They collect green waste. So we are proud to have Fairfax Companies as a sponsor since Mrs. Green's World began. Please check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com. Okay, everybody, take a deep breath. The name of our show today is Planting the Seed for Urban Farming. And it could also be called Changing the World Through Urban Farming. I am really honored to have as our guest today someone who has been planting seeds of many kinds for over 20 years, both the seeds that grow vegetables and seeds that have created movements and that shape and reshape cultures. Please join me in welcoming Will Allen, farmer, founder, and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. Will is recognized as a preeminent practitioner of urban agriculture in America and throughout the world. Wait till you hear about where some of his journey has taken him. He was very recently named Food Revolutionary, and I kind of want to ring the bell here, by our friends at the Rodale Institute on the first ever Rodale 100, a definitive list of 100 people, products, companies, and organizations positively impacting our world. And from where I sit, Will is a thought leader, a game changer, an innovator, and someone who brings about positive change in our world every day. And those of you who have been a part of this journey, you know how respect for that pours out of me. Let's get on with the show. Will, thank you. Did I embarrass you, or was that a good beginning to what's going to be a great show?
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for the introduction.
Well, people it's need great, to know who we have here.
Yeah, great to be on your show today.
Well, it's great to have you. So it was really funny when I was preparing for the show and reading your background. I found myself really smiling, and that kind of aha smiling you do, because it struck me in reading about your life that you were all along the way being prepared for a very big mission, the one that you're doing now. I'm not sure if you knew it. I know in my journey as Mrs. Green, I wasn't aware that everything I was doing was getting me ready for the big yes. So right. From your days on the farm as the son of a sharecropper to your amazing career as a professional basketball player to your corporate experience and to where you landed in Milwaukee. And I keep thinking about, you know, I'm a Jersey girl, but what's farming like in Milwaukee? Over 20 years ago, it was getting you ready to lead this amazing movement. So why don't we start with you just talking and sharing some of the highlights of your journey and how how you started getting reconnected to your farming roots in Belgium, of all places. So fill in some of the blanks for us. It's been quite a journey.
Well, you know, I come from a farming family, like most families at one time or another. But the unique thing about my family is the fact that we continue to farm. As we look back, as I was writing my book, The Good Food Revolution, and the research showed, and I didn't even know how far back, but it was like we traced it back 400 years
wow.
to today. So my family, unlike many families who stepped off the farm maybe five generations ago, we continue to farm. And my parents were really the key to passing on what I'm doing today to me. And like you said earlier, I didn't realize that I would be doing what I'm doing today because I had other plans for my life. You know, I grew up on a small farm. My father passed on a lot of the things I do today. And when I was in high school, I thought I was missing all the fun that all my schoolmates were having.
They were out playing and you were working on the farm.
Right, exactly. So I always had to get my farm work done before I could go out and play basketball or baseball or football. And so I always thought I was missing something. So I, at 18, I grew very big and became a high school All-American, All-American basketball player. And I had about 100 scholarship offers to go to colleges and universities back in 1967. And my goals back then were to go to college, get an education, and play professional basketball after college,
right.
Which I did. But I never thought I would ever go back to the farm. So when I got, my last stop was in Belgium, where I spent 3 years playing there. One of my Belgian teammates, his family had a farm, and I went out one day and helped him on the farm. I recall that we were planting potatoes, kind of the old-fashioned way, where they spaded up the ground. And in Belgium, the soil is so rich, and they do composting, and they were doing things that we're, a lot of people are just starting to do here in America again. And it reminded me of what we did on our farm. And as soon as I touched the soil, you know, I realized that something had changed within me, and all of a sudden I wanted to farm again. So I asked the team that I was playing for to move me out into the country, and I got 25 chickens, and I got bought some seed and spaded up a big area and started growing food. And I would share that food with all the other American players in Belgium, some of which, of course, played for other teams. But we were over there playing during the holidays, Thanksgiving and Christmas, and I'd have a big feast at my house during Thanksgiving and Christmas for everybody. And we would eat the food that my wife prepared, had canned and frozen and so forth. And we'd go up to the Shape military base and get a big turkey and ham and all that stuff. And so here I was back doing the same thing that my parents did, because we were known for the family that had all this food. We didn't have a lot of spendable income. My father was a construction laborer and had moved in the 30s during the great African-American migration to the South from his sharecropping. But we had something that was very valuable, which was the food that we grew.
Right.
The sustainable food. We didn't grow, we didn't use chemicals or anything, so we just did the kind of farming that I'm doing today. And we would feed lots of people. Almost every night, someone would show up at our home on the farm, and we'd feed them. And we sold some of the stuff that we grew, of course. And so that, here I am back doing the same thing. I found myself when I came back to America, well, even before that, doing the same thing, feeding folks, you know.
Right. Healthy food. Feeding them healthy food.
Yeah. Good food, yes.
Good food,
healthy
yes.
Food, yeah.
So the great part of this, and I didn't even have this in my list of the many questions I have for you, you truly have a life partner who also had her roots in farming. Your wife is there beside you making a lot of these really good things happen, including the cooking.
Yeah, my wife's family, her father grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. So he had farming roots, and then he went to Marquette University and became a professional football player for the Chicago Cardinals, who are now the Arizona Cardinals.
Don't I know that? We are in Arizona Cardinal country, and so sad. We won't talk about their playoff game. We'll talk about all the other good ones. Okay, let's move on from that.
So she was somewhat involved in farming, and when we came back to America, we actually started our farm on some land that they weren't using. But he was in the restaurant business. After he played professional basketball, professional football, he went to the Navy, and he was a cook in the Navy. And when he got out of the Navy, he started a restaurant, which was very successful in Milwaukee. So, she was ingrained in the food system as well.
Right. So you went to Milwaukee's North Side and started this journey that is now Growing Power Inc. Is that literally the roots, where the roots of this incredible organization got started?
Well, at first I had my own farm. I still have a 100-acre farm, and I was looking for a place. I was wholesaling some of my produce into Milwaukee, and I'd go to farmers markets, but I really wanted to a place that I could in a community that badly needed food. And I was just driving down the street. I was working for Procter & Gamble at the time in sales and sales technology, and I was driving down the street, and I ran across the last remaining farm in the city. I didn't know that at the time, but there was a sign for sale. It was an old greenhouse operation, about 3 acres with three houses. And I got lucky because there was a church that wanted a property to put this mega church and tear down the infrastructure and so forth. But the alderman, ex-priest, ex-farm boy, Don Richards, when I went and made my proposal to the real estate committee at City Hall, he liked my idea. He said, well, we already have enough churches and in my district.
And we need good food.
What you're doing is, you know, because part of my proposal is that I would work with some of the youth in the community and have them work on the farm and teach them about where their food comes from and how to grow food and so forth. So he really liked that. So if the alderman wants you to be there, you know, my next challenge, of course, was getting the funding. And I went to several banks, and I ran across a bank that thought that my idea was interesting, and they gave me a loan to be able to make the purchase from the city of Milwaukee, who owned the property at that time. So here I was with this old kind of rundown greenhouse operation in an area that used to be a farming area on the northwest side of Milwaukee. Actually, it was called Greenhouse Alley because a number of greenhouses resided there back in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And this was the last remaining registered farm in the city of Milwaukee. So I made that purchase, and here I was. I was going to actually use this as a for-profit entity. And I started working with the kids, and some of my friends who ran nonprofit organizations said, well, why don't you, since you like working with kids, why don't you start a nonprofit? So that's how the journey started with Growing Power.
You know, I want to like press pause for our listeners here, because what always amazes me, I say that I was being prepared for my journey, but I didn't get the final call from Mother Earth until about 10 years ago. And she was like, the name of my book is Your Mother Called, Mother Earth, you better call her back. And I didn't realize how she was calling me. But your journey, and when I say that from my heart about that smile that comes across your face when you're recognizing, looking at your journey, even when I read about your book, The Good Food Revolution, one of the reviewers, and the reviews are wonderful, named it a serious read. And in that, you know, it's all part of weaving the web of your journey. It is the kids and their need for fresh food and their interest in what you're doing that really helped move it forward. Is that an assumption, a fair one?
Well, I think the book really portrays the journey of many especially the African American
yes.
folks that were embedded in agriculture in the South in the 30s, the Great Migration. But unlike many African American folks that were involved in sharecropping and so forth and the history of slavery and all that, for some reason my father wanted us to, instead of just not wanting us to be part of something that was very painful for him down in the South, he wanted us to know where our food came from and for practical reasons to be able to grow some of our own food for our family
right.
and extended families and friends. So it was really a gift that I think about almost every day about him and my mother, who was this great cook and also a farm worker. If you read the book, my mother would always go out in the fields dressed very well, not like a farm worker. She wanted to dignify the art of farming and so forth. So, you know, all of that got passed on to me, and I've been able to pass that on to my kids.
Literally, the seeds were being planted inside
right.
of you. I mean, it's such a great metaphor, and I did not read the book. I wasn't even aware of it until I started doing research for the show, and I will read the book. These are the kinds of books that continue to inspire me, and there are dark days in this journey for me about what we're facing, not just in terms of our compromised food supply and organizations like Monsanto, and you know, the list goes on. There are down days for me. Fracking,
oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, let's talk about that. But your book, it's, I call it, you know, fuel for my soul, sustains my soul. So I will read your book. So let's go back to the ultimate, what I call is the life-changing direction. So the kids started getting interested. You formed a nonprofit and started doing urban agriculture. So tell me about what it looked like 20 years ago. I mean, now there's such a proliferation of farmers markets and local produce and all of that. What did it look like? And specifically, I want to ask you about, were you concerned back then about things like, you know, this is a long question, but you can take it one bite at a time, but things like GMOs and pesticides and herbicides. Was that something that you were aware of back then? How important do you think it is now? I mean, talk to us about what it really means to grow healthy food
right.
versus 20 years ago.
Well, I've always known that it's all about the soil, and I preach that all the time.
Yes, yes, yes. That's what Rodale says. Healthy soil, healthy crops.
Right. So you can't grow good food without good soil, and not using pesticides and that sort of thing goes back to my roots as growing up and so forth. We didn't use that. We composted. We had chickens, and we would compost from the nitrogen side, use our chicken waste on the nitrogen side. And
right.
of course, on the carbon side, we had straw and hay and leaves and stuff like that. So we were composting and growing this really good food, but it wasn't really back in those days being quantified at any way. You know,
right.
this was just like a natural thing that people did back then. And you know, as I moved and started this nonprofit, which is a unusual nonprofit in that when I started, I couldn't get any funding. You know, writing grants and stuff like that was something I had never done before.
Right. Right.
And I had a board who was doing the administration back in the early days, and they had other jobs and other things. So one of the things I decided to do right away was, you know, something I knew was to grow some food and sell it, and that would help fuel my work with the community and so forth. So that is something we still do today. Over 50% of our income comes from our farm operation. If you want to look at it, on one side of the street, we have our professional farm operation. On the other side of the street, we have our social trainings and workshops
right.
and working with youth and all the other things that we do. And that side of the street, that's our farming operation, helps fuel the other side of the street for our nonprofit. But one of the things that happened was there were a lot of naysayers when I first started 23 years ago.
Well, when we come back, we got to take a quick break. It came up so fast. That was 20 minutes. Are you kidding me right now? We'll be back. We'll start with the naysayers. Everybody stay here with me. More from Will Allen. We'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for being with us. Just another quick shout out to the Fairfax Companies for helping make this show possible. You can check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com, and I hope you do. The name of our show today is Planting the Seed for Urban Farming. And this man, who is our guest, planted a seed that has helped really change the world and craft urban farming. And I do not say that lightly. Please join me once again in welcoming our guest for this hour, Will Allen, the founder and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. Growing Power is a national nonprofit organization and land trust supporting people from diverse backgrounds and the environment in which they live, by helping those people and those communities provide equal access to healthy, high-quality, safe, and affordable food for people in all communities, something that we are still greatly challenged with as a nation. And a little bit more about Will. I like everybody to get to know more about our guests. He grew up on a small farm in Maryland, the second youngest of six children of a sharecropper. His mother and father planted a lot of seeds of him. In him, his father had very strict rules about no sports, no play until all the farm chores were done, and it served him well on many levels. Will went on to become a standout basketball player and the first African-American athlete at the University of Miami. And think about it, people. Think about how that was another, you know, he was changing all of the landscape way back then by being a first in many things. So fast forward to today, in the past 20 years of his life, he has been an innovator in methods of composting, vermicomposting, which is, for those of you that don't know, using worms to refine and fertilize compost, and aquaponics. It's growing so much in our area, growing fish and food plants in a closed system, going to be very important for our future, I believe. Growing Power is involved in more than 70 projects and outreach programs in Milwaukee, across the United States, and throughout the world. So, Will, welcome back. I do want our guest. We always have to have the getting to know you piece on Mrs. Green's World. So talk about the naysayers. Back then, it had not caught on. So you were you know, changing the landscape, the early adopter.
Right. There were a lot of naysayers when I started doing this, and I was going out and I was creating gardens on vacant lots. Milwaukee has a lot of vacant lots, over 5,000. So back then, you know, I would get this land and go out, and people would come up to me and say, especially African-American friends and folks that I knew, why are you doing this slave's work, is what they would say to
goodness.
Me.
Wow.
And way back then, and of course that's changed, but back then that's some of the response that I would get. And most of the people that were engaged in urban agriculture back then were you know, farmers, mostly white farmers or white organizations that were involved in the food system, and folks from universities that were studying communities and
right.
Agriculture being just starting in the cities as a part of that. So when you went to a meeting, you'd have just kind of crusty old farmers like me and folks from the universities that were studying what we were doing back then. But I realized at that time that I had to prove that this could cash flow. I had to prove that we could create jobs from urban agriculture and that we could expand urban agriculture throughout a city, throughout a community, and throughout the city, and get more people engaged and train more people. So my initial thought was not to be the largest urban ag organization in the world. That wasn't on my radar.
Right. One step at a time.
It was to prove that you could change the dynamics in a positive way in a community, to be able to bring in more food, to make sure that we're creating living wage jobs, which is one of the principles of our organization, and to end poverty is at the really crux of everything, is to make sure these communities where there's almost a shooting every night,
right,
in many of the cities around America, and surely Milwaukee and Chicago, where we do a lot of work. So So my goal was to train folks, break through, and prove that you could cash flow a significant size farm in the city of Milwaukee. So we just kept growing outside of our headquarters and started building hoop houses on larger spaces.
And what is that? Will, tell us, what is the hoop house?
It's a lot of people call them high tunnels in
okay.
the South or whatever.
Right.
And a lot of corporate companies like Driscoll and others use them out in California to grow strawberries and raspberries year round. And it's a somewhat of a controlled environment growing system where you build the quonsets or hoop houses or high tunnels. And then because the soil is contaminated, one of the things that we had to do is start a large composting operation.
Wow, yes.
Otherwise, we couldn't, if I didn't have compost, I couldn't grow any food in the city because we're growing on asphalt, on top of asphalt and concrete, hard pan clay. And
bad stuff.
So we started scaling up our composting operation first at our national headquarters, and then we got other sites to the point that last year we did about 40 million pounds of inputs to grow, thousands of yards of compost to be able to expand our operation. I wouldn't advise any nonprofit to, because people always come, a lot of these nonprofits, many come to Growing Power for tours and workshops, and they say, well, we want to be like you. And I tell them, I wouldn't do that. For the simple reason that I don't believe nonprofits, their role is to create these large growing systems. I think for nonprofits, they have a role in terms of engaging community people, training folks how to farm or something like that, but teaching them how to build infrastructure, but not to scale it up. I think this has to be done by entrepreneurs that we have to train how to grow inside a city, because it's a different way of farming than farming in a rural community. I come from a rural agricultural background, so I had to learn a lot and create a lot of different systems that would work in a urban setting, and dealing with a lot of things that one have to deal with in terms of you've got lots of people around you, where if you're in a rural setting, you're out on a tractor and you look around and all you see is the birds and the bees and nature.
Right, right. So the pollinators much, busy doing their thing. Yeah.
It's much different. So there was a lot of learning and a lot of research, kind of private research, and trying to figure out how to do this thing and be successful and be able to do it very intensively, because you're working. You don't look at I don't look at urban agriculture as acres of land. I look at it in terms of square footage. So how much can you grow in a square foot?
Right.
And you have to break it down to the different crops, because some crops yield a lot more per square foot in an annual year, And how can we grow year-round in these cold climates like Milwaukee and Chicago and Detroit and
right.
type cities? So there was a lot of work that evolved along a continuum. So it wasn't like all of a sudden I had this master plan. There was never a master
right.
plan.
It's, I so get that. It's like you're just on the journey.
Process,
yes.
You know? So,
yes, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. But I want to go back to a little bit to clarifying what you say to the nonprofits, because I hopefully we'll get into the whole issue of food security and food safety. So you tell them that in your vision, it would really be better to have entrepreneurs working to develop large-scale farming healthy practices, or do you encourage them to do what they're doing and have the other piece of it go on in scale? Because what you're talking about is scale. How do we ever compete with these, you know, big ag? How do we ever do that and get healthy food to the table?
Well, there's numbers. For example, when you look at Milwaukee, 5,000 vacant lots, there's lots of places that have got vacant buildings for aquaponics and aquaculture that could be used.
Right.
But what's the big challenge right now is that we don't have enough trained farmers to do the act itself. So we have to be patient, because we're going to have to grow some farmers. You know,
literally,
if we don't grow any farmers, we can't do this. If we don't grow any soil, because we can't grow an existing soil, all we have to do is and water, clean water, because all you have to do is look at Flint and one of the cities I've been to, and that needs a lot of help. And there's so many different things you have to deal with in an urban setting that you wouldn't necessarily have to deal with in a rural setting. But that's where everybody's moving. Everybody's moving to the cities.
And
these next generations, they want good food, and they want it close by. They want it to be local. They want it to be grown without chemicals. And we have to figure out a way. So these ideas that have been promoted, like one of our projects, Future Projects, is a vertical farm. To really figure out how to grow inside a vertical farm. And then we can look at Dixon Desponnier's idea of 50 and 100-story buildings to grow food in cities like New York or Boston or Vancouver, cities that don't have a lot of horizontal land mass. So we need to be thinking about the next generations. How are we going to feed 3.1 billion more people in the next 40 years.
In a very short amount of time. But you just explain for everybody what vertical farming is? You know, I'm cautioned sometimes by my new listeners that I'm so familiar with what that is. And I just went to another presentation at the University of Arizona at their College of Agriculture about vertical farming. But explain to our listeners what that is. It's growing up instead of out is my simple explanation for it.
Right. And there's a lot of people that try to define vertical farming as vertical walls. That's not what I'm talking about.
Right.
I'm talking about
right.
a building that's engineered
to grow things.
So that to grow things in greenhouses that are on top of each other.
Yes.
Many of these buildings could be multi-use facilities in terms of being able to train farmers to be able to have universities do research and offices in, to have a retail store on the base floor, but to grow a significant amount of food. But inside each greenhouse, there's a vertical system, so you're not growing on one plane. You may be growing on 7, 8, 10 different vertical in that vertical space. So, you know, my vision for a vertical farm is a building.
And Will, the thing about that, when you talk about the challenges that the farmers face, I mean, I would never, ever choose to be a farmer because it's so hard. And you are absolutely at the what happens if there's a hurricane? What happens if there's a frost? What happens if there's a rainy spell that kills everything? And vertical farming, it's answered so many of these, and it's why the venture capitals I think are capitalists are circling around saying, there's money in this, and for me, there's healthy food and opportunity for the entrepreneurial spirit, you know, who cares about the social capital and the good that'll come to society. So vertical farming gets me really excited. It's a way to go.
Yeah, one of the principles that we are preaching is that food that's grown in, say, you're in Phoenix, right?
I'm in Tucson, which is Tucson. Down the road a little bit. Yeah, but
okay.
Go up there
so
a lot.
Food that's grown in Tucson needs to stay in Tucson. It
yes.
doesn't need to be shipped to Florida or wherever, you know.
Right.
So that's what it's all about. It's about local production. It's about creating local jobs and hiring people from the local community. That's much different than a company coming in, using tax credits or something, and the cities give them a lot of land and stuff, and they grow this big monstrous hydroponic operation or something, and all.
And they're
the
going to ship it to California.
It,
that's what we always say. Yes, it's going to California, not staying here to feed our people.
Right. So that's what we're all about, is to make sure that food stays local. And what has happened with Growing Power, we deliver now to 7 wholesalers that have committed to using the food that we grow for them to stay in the local community. As a matter of fact, one wholesaler that we work with, Malio and Company, big operation, they had a lot of land. They paid for us to build hoop houses, and we're growing food that goes right in the side door of their operation. They process it, and it stays in the local community of Milwaukee.
And so it addresses the issue of food security. I mean, that to me is like one of the big things that when you look down into the, you know, the little looking glass, food security is going to matter more and more, people. It's having some local sources of food help you not become a food desert. So
right.
this makes sense on so many levels.
And you mentioned something earlier about increase in farmers markets, CSAs,
right.
box programs,
right.
and all that. But the majority of our population still shops in a box grocery store.
The huge majority, yes.
The big challenge for us is how do we get this good food into those stores?
Right, right, and to feed the masses.
And how do we get labeling or when you walk into the produce department, we need to have this, you know, huge letters up on the wall that says locally grown.
Yes. Yes.
Because that's what the last survey, about 86% of people said they'd rather eat locally grown food than food that's shipped for obvious reasons. So I think everybody's kind of realizing that it's fresher, it can be cheaper in terms of taking out the travel miles. We use renewable energy. If you use that, we grow our own soil. So the whole thing is about reducing the cost of good food so it becomes affordable and accessible to everybody.
And it's really, you know, and I do want to go back to where you saw things 20 years ago to the changing landscape now, because you can actually go into stores, and I see it here in Arizona, I see it in California, I see it in New York City, where I, you know, places I travel, there is the demand, the consumer is demanding it.
Right.
And it's got to be for you, someone that's been in there fighting the good fight for a long time, several decades, to see that people, I think the consumer is becoming more conscious every day and asking for what they want that they know that's better for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's very satisfying to me to walk into a box grocery store and see so much local food that's labeled and so forth. And we've worked with companies like Sysco, who we grow for.
Wow.
And they have been a big part of that, because I'll go to a restaurant or they deliver to just about everybody, institutions and so forth.
All over the country, yeah.
And I say, I look at a salad mix, because we sell, you know, each week we sell about 800 cases of salad mix to them. So I looked at the salad mixer and said, that's our salid mix. I know what we put in. You know.
It feels darn good. And then there's a part of me that wants to say, so what are those naysayers thinking about right now as they watch how this journey has unfolded? And I'm sure it's wonderful you have converts that are believers now.
I mean, it's important. Farming, for one thing, will keep you very humble, especially sustainable farming, because you can have so many. We grow about over 100 different crops and so forth. So not everything turns out. So
not everything turns out, and you keep going at it. Hold on, everybody. We'll be right back. Hold that thought. More from Will Allen from Growing Power, Inc. Lots more good stuff to share.
Mrs. Green's world's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's world is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. Please do remember to follow Mrs. Green's World on your favorite social media platform, because it's a great way to stay connected and be informed and to hear about great guests that we're going to have, like the one I'm getting to interview today. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, you name it, we're on it. LinkedIn, I'm certainly getting a very good business traffic connection on LinkedIn. And the other day I was at a meeting, just to share a little funny, and someone who's very good at social media said, you have to start doing Snapchat. And I looked him in the eye and said, I'm not doing Snapchat. So it's like, that's for the young kids. My 12-year-old grandson, he does Snapchat. So anyway, the name of our show today is Planting the Seed for Urban Farming. And I am truly honored, as I am sure all of you are, to have as our guest for this hour someone who's been planting seeds of change for over 20 years, seeds that grow vegetables and seeds that have created movements and are helping to shape cultures. Please join me once again in welcoming Will Allen, farmer, founder, and CEO of Growing Power, Inc. He is recognized as a preeminent practitioner of urban agriculture in America and throughout the world, which we haven't gotten to talk to. Will, I can hear show number two in my future. He was recently named Food Revolutionary by our friends at Rodale on the first ever Rodale 100. Rodale 100, what an honor. It's a definitive list of 100 people, products, companies, and organizations positively impacting our world. And I have to bring this up. I dug deep, Will Allen. As far back as 2008, he was awarded the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and named a MacArthur Fellow, only the second farmer ever to be so honored. And those are things that I hope our listeners hear and get inspired. And Will, I just want to share with you a comment that my husband shared with me. We are the Mrs. Green team, and he's our board op. And one of the things he commented on off air is so important for me, and I think for what you emphasized, is farmers markets are great. It's a feel-good thing. It builds community. There's the whole localist movement that gets fueled by that. But we have to keep our eye on a much bigger picture. It is not the only answer. We can have all the farmers markets. There could be one on every corner, and it's still not going to feed the masses. So they're great, and we want to support them, but we have to keep our eye on big yields, big food supplies. Yes?
Yes, and that's one of my things I think about every day. How do we figure out how to get food, the same good food, to everybody?
Yes. Yes.
At a reasonable price. And how do we make it accessible in those communities that don't have box grocery stores? They have to travel. For example, we're located 4 miles away from the closest box grocery store, east, west, north, and south. So high, densely populated area, here in the Silver Spring. The largest public housing project in Milwaukee is located 6 blocks away. We're the only good food in that 4 mile circle, or whatever you want to call it. So it's really important that we do feed the masses, figure out how we feed the masses, because they're the ones in these communities are eating really bad food. They're the ones that are going to meal programs and pantries and getting a bag of food that might not be good for them because of its
right heavy, packaged, over-processed, like zero nutrition. Don't get me started.
That's part of our realistic plan to fix that piece, but make it so that everybody is accessing that same good food. We shouldn't have different foods because of different economic situations. And I don't believe that we need to subsidize food. If we're able to get this good food price down in a local way by creating, like I said before, our own energy, because right now oil prices are low and everybody,
right.
you don't hear any politicians talking about renewable energy. We know it's not going to stay.
Right, the short-sighted syndrome. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's good today. Let's go with that.
And to be able to grow good soil, because even our food that's grown in rural areas is not good food because the soil is contaminated in rural areas, suburban areas, and urban areas. So we have to use the waste that we put in the landfill to be able to grow healthy soil. So
right.
that's what we have to do. That's what we have to increase. I'm hearing about different grant programs around the country for composting now. 10 years ago, everybody was like, oh, you know.
Forget about it.
It smells. blah,
right.
blah, blah. So now we have funders, USDA and others, that are funding folks to really learn how to grow really good soil, because that's what we have to do. We have the right balance of carbon and nitrogen to grow this really good soil.
I just
want to say, when we when we go back to the start, when there were a lot of naysayers, especially a lot of folks from the African American community that had gone through such hardship and moving to the north during the Great Migration. But the one person I give tremendous credit for is the First Lady, who I've had an opportunity to work with.
Yes.
When she put that small garden on the White House lawn, it's estimated that over 10 million people started growing food again, or for the first time.
10 million?
Yeah, and many of those people were people of color. So she has helped tremendously. She stuck to her guns with Let's Move. I was just in Italy with her for the Milan Expo and had a chance to, I had quite a few chances to work with her. So she is a real leader in this food movement from her position as being the First Lady. And I think that has helped us a lot.
And I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, I got one trip to the White House. I got to be in the same room with the First Lady for the kids' state dinner, where, you know, they have kids from all over the country come and they win a prize. And my friend, Haley Thomas, got to introduce the First Lady. And, Will, I so kid you not, she was 12 at the time. And she introduced the First Lady with such presence and poise and confidence. I mean, she's here in Tucson and doing unbelievable things. But we got to see, you know, I call it the first garden and the first bees. I mean, they've got bees there, too. So it was an incredible change, and I had no idea. I wrote that down for a Twitter. 10 million people started farms after that. I mean, that's impact.
Yeah, there was a huge impact. It helped move a lot of people of color back into
started growing. Yeah.
Yeah. So if they weren't in a game, they came into the game, and that has continued to grow. So the transformation from 23 years ago to today is just really remarkable in terms of who, and young people. that naysayers said, "Oh, those young people, they don't want to touch the soil. They don't want to get involved." But we found the opposite, because kids in communities, they don't have a lot to do. If you introduce them to younger ones to growing food, and then the teens, like we have a program in Chicago where we work with about 400 teens a year. We pay them. If you pay those teens as their first job,
right,
then a lot of them get hooked into this work, and they go into college and they take biology and so forth. So there's so many good things that can come out of growing food.
The thing that strikes me, and I really don't want to interrupt, but you're really, really talking about this. It's systemic change. And what frustrates me greatly is if you are raising healthy kids in some of the highest risk neighborhoods, it's like money in the bank. If you want to look at it from the
right.
capitalist point of view, you're preventing all kinds of disease that we all pay for. So
Right. Fix
the healthcare system. Fix the food supply, people. Go upstream and start feeding kids healthy foods, and you'd be really surprised at how healthcare prices would go down. The cost of healthcare would go down.
And I really applaud all those youth-serving organizations that may have had a different mission and vision, but they brought food into their organization.
Yes, yes.
And of course, what Alice Waters...
Yes! Oh my gosh!
Has done in the edible schoolyard and what Michael Pollan talks about.
Yep.
We need all of those folks talking about the food system, and you know, we have to be realistic. The industrial food system isn't going to go away. But my feeling is we need to give folks a choice when they walk into a grocery store. Do you want to buy processed foods in the middle of the store, or you want to go on the exterior walls and buy some good stuff and locally grown stuff?
That tastes good. I mean, you have people like Lori David with Fed Up, and one of my early guests who I just have become friends with, he visits me every time he comes to Phoenix, is Steve Ritz, the Green Bronx Machine. He is cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, and he loves when I say that, but this man is... a zealot, and I love it. I took a tour of what he did. I'm a Jersey girl, and we went to the South Bronx, and we went to Harlem, and all of a sudden, under a bridge for one of the, you know, the subways, you have a farm, and you have daycare, and you have sheep, and you have chickens, and you have social justice issues being addressed by change, not by being talked about, but by, look at this, look what we've got here under the bridge. So that's my little rant. He's great.
Yeah, Stephen is really great, and I've got to do a couple talks with him, and he's just wonderful what he's doing with those young people.
It is. Talk about inspirational. And I went in one of those buildings where everywhere you look, I mean, there's vertical farming. There, he does have growing walls. He's got you name it. It's going on, and it's healthy. It's kind of sad to me. I don't want to be sad on any of my shows that we have about 7 minutes left, because I did want to talk a little bit about, take it further, not just the health of kids changes, but what other kinds of ripple effect. And I told you off air, you know, I have 35 years in working with at-risk families in their neighborhoods. So I know about success, and my focus was mental health, you know, at risk and helping them stay out of the systems. But what I believe, and I want to know if you believe it because you've got more boots on the ground experience, is when you start helping kids to get reconnected to the earth and the soil, other magic happens in school and with families and with parents and with attendance at school. Do you want to just comment on that from your experience? What other things you see happening just as a result of growing food?
Sure. I mean, a lot of great things have happened in Milwaukee around folks that we get about 30,000 visitors a year.
Oh, my goodness.
Many schools visit us during the entire year. But one of the key things that kids get is when they get connected to the soil. It's a very spiritual thing that touches the soil. And kids get when they touch the soil, it changes their lives, you know. And
forever.
I'm not saying that every one of these kids are going to wind up being farmers.
Right.
But when you look at how many jobs there are in the food system, we want them to have an opportunity, but it all starts with the soil, that they get connected and they want to go to college and they want to take biology or whatever, other courses, business courses or whatever, whether they decide they want to be an attorney and they might come back and they want to work for a nonprofit and help them, a nonprofit who's growing food like what we do. So there are hundreds of job opportunities, but it starts with these young people getting an opportunity to be trained in a program, a nonprofit program. And we've sent many kids to college. I have 4 young people in college right now.
Oh my goodness.
That we've been able to get scholarships, full scholarships, to go to school. We've got one at Florida A&M University in an ag program. We've got one at Tuskegee. We had one that just graduated from Fort Valley State in Georgia, and one at a local school here, and we've graduated quite a few others that went into the culinary arts. So it leads a lot of kids into culinary arts, and they become chefs and so forth. So I don't see any downside.
There is none. There just isn't one. I mean, you've got a believer in that, and the whole, we're not going to get into it, but I have to comment because it's who I am. But when you talk about what it costs to support a human being in prison and the social capital and how society is being robbed of that human being, and then you look at what you can do in terms of a ripple effect for real systemic change. It breaks a cycle forever, forever and ever and ever. It's like done, period. I'm never going back to that. So why we're not on board supporting these programs? That, like I said, that's a 6-hour marathon show that we still wouldn't come up with all the answers.
And that's something we have to do, and we have done in terms of working with folks that were incarcerated and have felony records that couldn't get hired. And we have a program that was partially funded by the city to teach these folks how to work in the food system. And we started with them helping to build the hoop houses and so forth as a construction piece, and later transitioned them into actually growing food. It's a very difficult thing to do. The attrition rate is very high.
Right.
But
right.
The ones that you can
engage,
engage and get them to stick to the program, because they come in with a lot of issues that you almost have to have on staff, a social worker and a psychiatrist or a psychologist for that population. But we can't give up on that population. So what's been really wonderful is that a lot of teachers now come to us to get trained to learn how to work with kids in their ag programs at school. So we're working with about 37 different schools, and aquaponics has become a very important piece, because that's something that kids really gravitate to, being able to grow plants and fish in the same system and designing different types of systems. So when you look at it, that might lead a young person to engineering school. As they start to engineer their own systems, they get excited about that and say, I want to learn more. And those are the folks that we're going to need in the future to engineer these vertical farms and different types of innovative systems to be able to grow food inside cities.
And there's so many things left. We have. Are you ready for this, Will? Time flies when you're getting really great guests on the show. We have 1 minute left, and I want to tell everybody how to connect with you. And it's, you know, growingpower.org. You have a very active, robust, lots of followers on Facebook, Growing Power, Twitter. You've got a great social media person on Growing Power. You're on Instagram. Wonderful, beautiful pictures on Growing Power. And can you do like a 30-second takeaway for people who are listening? You have to shout it out. One thing that you should think, you say, people should consider doing.
Go ahead. I think what people should do is get involved, because we need everybody at the table. Years ago, we only had a few people at the table, but every occupation, whether it's your political person or a corporate, work for a corporate company or a farmer. Or
get involved.
Get involved.
Will Allen.
In your community around food.
You're all that. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.